You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. Today's show is brought to you by Ducks Unlimited. Get involved, attend a DU fundraiser in your area, and help conservation and protect habitat and your ability to hunt it. Hey everybody, welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Rob Dreeslein, going to be with you for the next hour. We're going to talk with Eric Mitchell from the Minnesota DNR a little bit about the state's elk planning. They've got a big meeting actually next week. We're going to talk about elk management in Minnesota. We'll get some more details from him about that. We're also going to chat with Phil Borjali. He's a shotgunning writer from Iowa. I'm really looking forward to chatting with Phil. We're going to talk a little bit about a story he had last week on the 10-gauge, which is something that if it gets used, it usually gets used for goose hunting, and that early goose hunting is underway here in Minnesota. Started this past Sunday, September 1st. Tim Lesmeister will help me wrap up the show here in about 45 minutes, but going to kick it off, as usual, with Tim Spielman. Tim, welcome. Good to see you. And, yeah, bird season's underway. Early goose, dove season is also cooking. Isn't it? And early teal.
And early teal, yeah. They all opened September 1. I was going to say, I read that story that Phil had about the 10-gauge.
Yeah.
And I was I was really interested in the recoil section because I remember shooting at one of the few geese that were around when I was a kid. I don't know how big I was, teenager, 16, 17. And my friend had a 10-gauge. And it was a double barrel.
Okay.
And he let me use it, and I fired at a goose, and I pulled both triggers at the same time. Ooh. Unknowingly, and so both barrels went off.
Wow.
And maybe the loads have changed things, but that about knocked me on my butt.
Yeah, I believe it. Did you get the bird, Tim?
No, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure I didn't. I would have remembered that. Yeah, so 10-gauges are cool. They seem like just massive guns these days when everybody's kind of leaning more toward using 20s and 28s and things like that. So,
if they're looking for a big load, they're going with a 12-gauge 3.5-inch. Yeah, that's kind of made those 10-gauges obsolete. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to Phil. I've never interviewed him before. I suspect he's going to be a pretty good guy.
Yeah. The early, they all open on Sunday, the early teal, early goose, and doves. And Tori wrote a good story about the waterfowl side of things. And, you know, it's going to be, those seasons are always hit or miss. You're not shooting migrating birds. You're not waiting for that big late November push of mallards and things like that. Obviously, because the mallard season isn't open. But, it's all dependent on if you've got local birds and if you've done your scouting so you know where they're at. And that always plays out on these early openers.
Yeah, it sounded like not a lot of hunting pressure, despite the weather being absolutely gorgeous. I mean, we complained about how hot it was last year and the year before for folks going out and attempting that early teal thing. And, man, they had just beautiful morning weather to go out and hunt birds. We should point out, as folks are listening to this, the season is over for early teal. It ended on, what, Thursday the 5th?
Correct.
Yeah, so that's wrapped up. Early goose continues through.
Goes through the 15th.
Okay, so good opportunities there still. Morning doves still can hunt them as long as they stay in the state. And of course, next weekend's the big opener, right? With we got the archery opener as well as rough grouse, right? Squirrel, yep. Rabbit, all your kind of normal small game seasons get going, with the exception of pheasant. That's like, yep, October, is it 14th?
14th,
yeah. Yep. And we should point out, normally this week's print edition of Outdoor News, we usually We'll have the pheasant report, the August roadside survey to have a good forecast for pheasant hunting. The DNR did not get us that this past Tuesday. Perhaps they did by the end of the week. And if so, I encourage folks to go to OutdoorNews.com. As you're listening to this, you might be able to see that we might have that report posted now. But, yeah, a little disappointing how late that – every year it comes a little later, doesn't it, Tim?
It seems like it. Some years it's, you know, you've had a fairly normal, per se, year. This year, at least my curiosity is piqued by the fact that we had a winter with no winter, mm-hmm. but we had a lot of rain, and we heard reports about drowned out nests and
right.
chicks succumbing to the multiple inches of rain that we had in a lot of areas. So I'm still very curious to see how that plays out.
Yeah, maybe it'll be kind of a wash, good winter, bad spring, but so it'll be similar to last year. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows?
Maybe some of the birds pulled off some late hatches. We had a little bit drier conditions as we got into July. Maybe that'll mean some broods coming up will provide some opportunity. But yeah, tough year for pheasants, we think. We'll see what that report contains. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Driesline and Tim Spielman were kicking off this week's broadcast. Tim, you had a story about kind of how the DNR is revamping its oversight committees, the budget oversight committee, that is. You want to share with listeners what the gist of that story was about?
Yeah, and I think I mentioned in a column of a couple of weeks ago, and it was something that the DNR was in favor of, but it was a legislative move. And there's been there were two committees, the Wildlife Oversight Committee and the Fisheries Oversight Committee, I believe. Mm-hmm. And they members from those groups, select members, formed the Budgetary Oversight Committee, which it's all citizens, and they look at the DNR spending from the Fish and Game Fund, which is the one that we pay probably more attention to than others, because it's what happens with our the dollars we spend on licenses from fishing to hunting and other ones. So that BOC, the Budgetary Oversight Committee, is being dissolved basically at the end of this year to be replaced by, all three of those committees will be, to be replaced by a new Fish and Wildlife Advisory Committee. Hmm. And I haven't talked to anyone who's really against it. Even the current chair of the BOC thinks it's a good idea. We'll see how it works. But these reports, and I don't know if we've reported them on them in the past, but they really are interesting. They do great breakdowns of how money is spent and where. I mean, if you're into that kind of thing, it's kind of cool to look at the various accounts that are part of that Game and Fish Fund.
Mm-hmm.
So they go through that with a fine-tooth comb, and they make recommendations whether or not, you know, the DNR isn't obligated, but it's nice that there's a group like that that says, here's what we think, these are our recommendations. And they can ask for responses. Well, the DNR does respond with its own report, which usually shows up in November or December, where the DNR officials respond to some of these items. So it's a nice little checks and balances, I guess, type system with citizens instead of state employees.
Well, it just feels like, how can you have as much oversight with one committee as you used to have with, what, two or three?
Yeah, and it's composed of 15 members who are appointed by the DNR commissioner, and I know there's not a good, clean way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the way it's with all sorts of government
sure.
committees and things like that. You know, they've got to be appointed by someone. So
right.
so that's how it is. So we'll see. They've got a different sort of reporting system. I can't explain it to you real thoroughly right now, but it'll operate slightly differently.
And they did have, what, a recent bullet point you cited to they recommended a swan season. Am I summarizing that correctly?
Yeah, they covered multiple points, and they quite far ranging. But yes, one of them was to, and I think it might have been under the header of how does the DNR raise additional revenue.
There you go.
And and one of them was to implement a swan season for additional yeah. revenue participation in swan population control.
Yeah, there you go. We got a whole new species to hunt and drive mm-hmm. some new license revenue. I like it.
Cool. Yeah, I won't count my chickens on that one, but
yeah.
But that was one of them. I mean, they had several, but that was one that jumped out to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a good one. Listeners know that I've been advocating for that. I think it's a good idea. I don't know if it would generate long-term revenue to them, but it'd be a couple years. I think some people would go out and want to bag a swan.
Yeah, I would think so.
Well, hey, read all about it, that complete story. It's off the front cover of this week's print edition of Outdoor News. So check that out. Tim, good to see you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Yep, sounds really good.
All right, Tim Spielman, editor at Minnesota Outdoor News. We're going to break. We're going to talk elk when we return. This is Outdoor News Radio.
Hunting season will be here before you know it, and it's time to get ready for your next adventure with the OnX Hunt app. Whether you're traveling in search of roosters, elk, waterfowl, or looking to score on a whitetail close to home, OnX Hunt can help you be more successful this season. Route, plan, and navigate with private and public land boundaries, recent imagery, offline maps, and Minnesota-specific hunt layers. Download the Hunt app on the App Store or Google Play and join the millions of hunters that trust OnX Hunt.
Ready for your next fishing adventure? Look no further than Lake City, Minnesota. Located in southeast Minnesota, nestled along the shores of Lake Pepin, this charming town offers some of the best fishing in the Midwest. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, Lake Pepin is teeming with walleye, bass, and more. And when you're not on the water, explore Lake City's quaint shops, delicious dining, and scenic beauty. Go to visitlakecity.org today and plan your trip to Lake City, Minnesota's South Shore.
Looking for the perfect summer getaway? Look no further than Minnesota's own Lake of the Woods. Welcome to the walleye capital of the world, where the next hook set could be your personal best fish of a lifetime. But it's not just about the fishing. From cozy resorts to charming lodges, Lake of the Woods offers summer fun for everyone. Plus, our charters and expert fishing guides are ready to make your experience unforgettable. Discover the magic of Lake of the Woods. Visit lakeofthewoodsmn.com.
Since 1967, generations of Minnesota sportsmen have trusted Outdoor News to keep them up to date with the latest news, pro tips, features, fishing reports, gear reviews, and more. For less than $1 per week, you can carry on the tradition and join thousands of Minnesota sportsmen by subscribing to Outdoor News. Whether you prefer a printed copy in your mailbox each week or the convenience of up-to-the-minute news on your smartphone or computer, we've got you covered. Subscribe today at outdoornews.com/subscribe.
I love this song!
I love nachos.
Loving everything? You might be buzzed.
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzz warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Why should you take a Minnesota DNR firearm safety course? Hi, this is DNR Conservation Officer Adam Block. Many states require hunters to furnish evidence of having completed a hunter education course before issuing a non-resident license. Don't let your next trip to your favorite hunting spot be cut short because of your lack of education. Take a DNR hunter education course. For more information, call 800-366-8917.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, a nationwide group working to keep public lands in public hands so future generations can enjoy what we enjoy. Join the group that makes a difference. Check us out at backcountryhunters.org.
Welcome back, everybody. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Driesline back with you. Welcome to the broadcast. Hope you enjoy what we chat about here. If you do, check us out online at outdoornews.com. We've got digital versions you can subscribe to there. You can also subscribe to the print version, again, at outdoornews.com, or call us at 800-535-5191. Outdoor News makes a great holiday gift. Now that the state fair is in the rearview mirror, I can say that to folks. I want to talk about elk in Minnesota. I have mentioned before, I think a lot of people don't even realize we have an elk herd here in our fine state. It's in northwestern Minnesota. And the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is trying some things to manage elk a little more aggressively, maybe even grow the herd. There's talk of expanding the herd and moving some animals to northeastern Minnesota, see if we can establish a second herd over there. And here to talk about some of those different facets of elk management is Eric Mitchell from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Eric is the agency's ungulate research scientist, and he joins us now. Eric, welcome. I hope summer has treated you well as we start to transition into autumn.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Yeah, you've joined us before on the program, and I appreciate you carving out some time. Let's start with kind of just establishing, what do we have for elk in Minnesota? Can you give us a little bit of the history about this species in our state?
Yeah, we've always had elk throughout the state of Minnesota. Currently, they're restricted to the northwestern part of the state. We have three subpopulations comprising less than 200 animals in total.
Are all of those elk the result of herds that were transplanted or reestablished in Minnesota after they were driven to extinction, I guess you might say, during the settlement and market hunting era? Or is there some evidence that, like, that border herd that goes between Manitoba and Minnesota is actually native elk that were never extinct?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a little bit of a hodgepodge what we have right now. That border herd still exists, and most of those elk reside on the Canadian side of the border, but those elk have been restored from several different aspects.
So you're saying the elk that do go back and forth between Manitoba and Minnesota, that is also a restored herd that's not what I guess I would call native elk that were never driven extinct?
Oh, no. So that is still a native population.
Okay.
Yeah, but that population could have sourced some of the other elk that we have in the state. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I think that's a pretty big deal that we still have, you know, this. Is there another native elk population in the eastern half of the United States? I don't think there is. You know, the only other quote unquote native elk are out west, correct?
There's been a lot of restoration efforts east of the Mississippi to bring elk back. Yeah.
Right. But none of those are native.
None of those are native. Correct. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So we've got this elk herd in the state. And what do we want to do? What is the agency? What's the goal with elk in Minnesota? Is the overarching aim to try to expand the number of elk we've got? You said we've got about 200. Do we want to have more?
Well, right now we're still mandated to manage these populations within a certain level. So we have each of the three subpopulations that we have to manage for a certain number. Recent legislation is allowing us to modestly grow our Lancaster population, which is the largest population that we have out of those three. So right now we're just working within those means.
And by modestly, you mean like really modestly? I mean, we're able to grow it. It's at 75 and we can grow it up to almost 100?
Exactly. A very modest number.
That went through the legislature to, I guess, allow these herds to grow anymore. We need it to pass the legislature?
Right now we're mandated to actually manage within a certain level. So when we fly our aerial surveys in the wintertime, if we count a number that's above what we're supposed to manage for any of those given populations, then that's when we issue tags and try to harvest animals out of the population.
And we have elk hunting in the state, right? The state issues some tags and the bands issue some tags, mostly the Red Lake band, right? How many elk are we killing in Minnesota every year right now?
It's a pretty small number. It's about 15, give or take the year.
Mm-hmm. So, Eric, you've got some elk research brewing right now. Tell us a little bit about that. What's the point of the research, and how is this going to unfold?
Yeah, there's only been one past study conducted on the elk in Minnesota, and that was conducted back in 2016. There's just a lot of unknowns about this population, so that's really what we're picking up. We're using the information that we learned from that 2016 study, and we're trying to expand on it. So basic things like home range size, resource use. One of the bigger unknowns for us right now is mortality. We don't know what the survival rates are for these elk. We don't know what they're perishing to. Just some of that basic information.
Do we have any clue what's causing elk mortality? I mean, generally these herds are pretty stable, aren't they? I mean, other than hunting tags, what else? I suppose there's some car kills. Do we think there's some poaching? Do we think a wolf? We got a few wolves that wander through that part of the state. Are they taking any?
So we think that we have a pretty stable population. We don't think that we have high mortalities by any stretch of the imagination. Predation is going to be one of those factors. Wolves, bears, we still have the same predator guild in northwestern Minnesota that we have in northeastern Minnesota. But what does that actually look like? Is it the adults that are getting picked off a little bit in the wintertime? Is it the calves that are receiving more pressure? We don't know. So that's kind of what we're going to be looking at.
So what do you need from the public for this study to unfold properly, Eric?
Well, most of northwestern Minnesota is privately owned, so a lot of these elk are on private lands. So in order to get a better understanding of all the things we want to look at, we need access to those private lands. So we sent out a landowner letter a few weeks ago now, just requesting permission and access to properties to capture elk and monitor those elk. So any participation that we can have from the public is really going to help us out a lot.
How's that going so far? Are you getting cooperation from local landowners?
We are. We're getting a pretty decent response back, and it's about 50-50 so far with access. So I think it's going fairly well so far.
How long is the study going to happen, Eric? Tell us how it's going to unfold.
We'll start capturing adult elk this winter, so January, February of 2025. And then we will capture calves this next spring in 2025. And we'll have two capture seasons, so winter of 2025 and winter of 2026. And we'll monitor their movements and survival for about 2.5-3 years post-capture.
How does that process go, capturing an elk? These are big animals. Tell us what that looks like on the ground.
Yeah, so we're contracting out with a helicopter capture company, and basically they fly around. We have a spotter plane that will spot the herd, and if we have access to that property, then the capture company will fly over. And there's a couple different ways you can do this. You can either sedate the animal, which is a great way to go about it, especially when you have to insert any technology on those animals, like vaginal implant transmitters that we'll be using.
Yeah, I would think having them sedated would help with that, yeah.
Or you can use a net gun. And because anytime you sedate an animal, there's inherent risk to the animal. Sedation is a dangerous process, right? So sometimes, depending on what information you need from the animal, it's better to not sedate them. And then you can just use a net gun, basically, and hobble their legs, put a blindfold on them, and get whatever data you need from them that way.
We're chatting with Dr. Eric Mitchell, DNR ungulate research scientist, about an elk study that will be kicking off this winter. Is that correct, Eric, pretty much?
That's correct, yep.
Yeah, and it'll be going for at least a couple of years. So we'll look forward to seeing, you know, how that unfolds. I'll try to maybe get a reporter up there. I'd love to get some pictures of that process, Eric, but we can talk more about that later. In the meantime, next week, Tuesday, September 10th, we've got a Northwest Elk public meeting. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we're going to be meeting up in, I believe, Thief River Falls, just to discuss the research project and elk management in general.
This will be Tuesday, September 10th at Northland Community and Technical College. The Performance Art Theater there in Thief River Falls runs 6 to 8 p.m. Can folks also stream that meeting, Eric, do you know?
No, I don't believe there's going to be a streaming option, because we're going to have some breakout sessions where people can actually have an opportunity to voice any concerns or ask any specific questions, and those will be in different room.
Tell us a little bit about what the DNR is hoping to accomplish at this meeting.
Well, in terms of the research project, really, like I mentioned before, we had those landowner letters that went out. And this meeting serving as an opportunity for those landowners to come in and actually just ask whatever questions they have and get more information that they want about the research project. We're going to be discussing a lot about elk management. We haven't had a meeting like this to discuss elk management in quite some time. So really, again, just serving as a venue for anybody who has any questions to ask them about elk management, kind of what some of our goals are and what we're hoping to do.
Citizens, of course, statewide are welcome to attend this, but Thief River Falls is a long way for most of the population of this state. Is there any way that metro residents, I mean, we all have a stake in elk management here in Minnesota. Is there a way other folks around the state can chime in on this?
They can always just give us a call directly to myself, Kelsey Lashar. She's our statewide elk coordinator. So any questions about elk management or about the elk research project, we're always happy to chat about it.
How can folks reach you, Eric?
They can either email me directly at eric.mitchell@state.mn.us, or they can call my office number directly at 507-578-8918.
That's Eric, E-R-I-C dot Mitchell, M-I-C-H-E-L.
At state.mn.us.
Okay. Or 507-578-8918. DNR also has a good webpage devoted to elk, mndnr.gov/elk. That's the DNR elk management webpage. Check that out. I presume folks might be able to reach you just through that webpage also, Eric. Well, good luck with the meeting. I hope there's some good turnout. I hope there's good feedback. I hope there's some support for elk management and growing the elk herd in the state at that meeting and going forward. I hope we learn more about this important species that it seems like the population of elk is trying to grow if people would just let it. Meanwhile, we got moose, you know, which everybody loves, and we want to see that population grow, and they're struggling. So I wish we'd work more with Mother Nature, and I hope this research helps that occur, Eric.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this opportunity for this project. We're going to learn a lot about this population.
Well, thanks for spending a segment with me. Good luck, and we'll be in touch as the research unfolds, Eric.
Sounds great. Thanks again for having me.
You bet. That was Eric Mitchell, Minnesota DNR ungulate research specialist, talking about some research on our elk herd in northwestern Minnesota, as well as a public meeting occurring next Tuesday, September 10th. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
Fort Dodge, Iowa? Outdoor and entertainment adventures are awaiting you. Discover Iowa's largest off-highway vehicle park, Gypsum City OHV Park, with 60 miles of trails, mudding areas, tracks, and an obstacle course. The area also boasts water, paved mountain bike, and equestrian trails. Head into town to enjoy public art and studios, an orchard, aquatic center, and family entertainment venue. Fill up with excellent Korean cuisine, pizza, ice cream, craft beer, or local wines. For more information, visit DodgeTheOrdinary.com.
Attention hunters, are you ready to take your hunting game to the next level? OutdoorNews.com is your ultimate hunting partner. Stay up to date with the latest hunting trends, gear reviews, and expert tips from seasoned hunters. OutdoorNews.com provides the most comprehensive hunting news to ensure you're always in compliance with local laws. Whether you're a seasoned pro or a beginner, OutdoorNews.com is for you. We're passionate about preserving our hunting heritage and fostering responsible hunting practices. OutdoorNews.com, where hunters become legends.
Okoboji, Iowa has thousands of acres of lakes for fishing and public land for hunting, making it Iowa's best outdoor playground all year long. Start planning your next trip to Okoboji for fishing, hunting, swimming, or camping in one of our state parks. When you get off the water, enjoy our many locally owned restaurants and attractions, making Okoboji a favorite destination for your entire family. Plan your next trip at vacationokoboji.com. Okoboji, Iowa's best outdoor playground.
Thinking about buying or selling rural real estate in Minnesota? Whitetail Properties Real Estate is the premier brokerage for buying or selling hunting land, farmland, and country homes. With local professionals and a national presence, no other brokerage can provide you with the same buying or selling experience as Whitetail Properties. To learn more about the current real estate market or connect with your local land specialist, stop by their booth at the upcoming Minnesota Deer and Turkey Classic or visit whitetailproperties.com.
Hey, hon, what you doing with your phone? Taking pictures?
No, I'm asking you questions.
Like what?
Hey, Bobo, do flowers have best friends?
I'm sorry. I'm afraid I don't know that.
Hey, follow me. I want to show you something. Look, flowers do have best friends.
Whoa.
Some answers can only be found in nature. Discover the unsearchable. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a trail near you. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Welcome back, everybody. Outdoor News Radio, Rob and Jerisline. Happy to be with you for another segment. Hope you're enjoying the broadcast. If so, please check out our website, outdoornews.com. You can subscribe to our digital version there. You can also subscribe to our print version or call us at 800-535-5191 if you'd like to subscribe. Outdoor News makes a great holiday gift. Now that the State Fair is in the rearview mirror, I feel I can already start mentioning that to listeners. Hey, hunting season's kicked off September 1st. They are underway as we speak for a number of species, including mourning doves. Early Canada goose is underway, black bear. Got a bunch of other seasons that are going to start unfurling here in coming weeks. I wanted to make a transition here and talk to someone who's never joined me on the broadcast before, but you've seen his name in Outdoor News. He's Phil Borgeli. He's based down in Iowa City, Iowa, and arguably the best shotgun writer in the country, I dare say. Probably a modest individual who wouldn't agree to that, but he's a columnist, Field & Stream, shotgun columnist for Field & Stream, as well as Ducks Unlimited, and he joins us now. Phil, thanks so much for carving out some time.
Hey.
Looking forward to autumn?
Yes, I am. I try not to let myself get excited about it until it's just right about to happen. Now we're there.
Got
doves and teal. And I'm very excited for both and for whatever else the fall holds.
That's right. Early teal season also on September 1st. So I forgot to mention that. Just so folks get to know you a little bit, tell us about your background. How'd you get into outdoors writing and become so focused on this shotgunning niche?
You know, I fell into all of it. Honestly, many years ago, I had too much time on my hands and I read a lot of outdoor magazines and I kept thinking, well, I can do this. And I was lucky enough to sell my first story to Field & Stream, which, you know, was a top market. But then it was a couple of years until I sold my second story. I was lucky to have a very supportive wife. And you know, I came late to hunting. And I think that's why, you know, a lot of times it's those late converts that are the ones that stay with it forever and love it the most. And that's me. So all I ever wanted to write about was the outdoors and hunting. You know, the shotguns, part of that is just a accident of where I'm from. There's nothing in Iowa that I ever hunted with a rifle. So I always wrote about shotguns. And And then the opportunity came up to just start doing the column for Field and Stream. And I've been doing it since 2000 and DU since 2010. I'm not exactly sure. The years,
okay.
years pile okay. up on these.
Well, obviously, yeah, a lot of great bird hunting opportunities in Iowa with pheasants and waterfowl for sure. You had a piece in the most recent edition of Outdoor News about the 10-gauge, which we don't seem to hear as much about anymore. I really like the way you wrote the piece. It was exactly what I was looking for. It was kind of, hey, don't forget the 10-gauge. They're still around. They were sort of, as you said in your article, they were on a bit of a roll, what, as the lead shot era for waterfowl yeah. kind of came to a close. And then the 3.5-inch 12 came along and kind of stopped their momentum. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, their role didn't last very long. You know, between the nationwide adoption of non-toxic shot and the introduction of the 3.5-inch 12 gauge wasn't very long. And that really, really killed the 10 gauge. You know, it was about to have its moment and it just didn't work out. And as I think I said in the story, it's a very specialized gun.
You know, uh-huh.
Nobody really needs a 10 gauge, but they're fun.
So you know, for the layman out there, I mean, we have listeners who don't maybe understand calibers and bores as well as you or I. What does that mean, 10 gauge versus 12 gauge versus 16 versus 20? Can you kind of explain that in quick layman's terms?
The 10 gauge is the largest bore diameter allowed in the United States in modern waterfowl hunting. It makes it the biggest gun you can take to the field. 10 gauge is a 7.75, almost 3/4 inch bore. 12 gauge in contrast is about 730/1000 of an inch. So
okay, a little smaller.
It's smaller. The 10 gauge can hold more shot than a 3-inch 12 gauge, about the same as a 3.5-inch 12 gauge. And it's a big gun. There's a big frame and a big gun, and they tend to weigh 10 to 12 pounds. It's not something you want to carry in the field, but for hunting where the car or the boat or the ATV or whatever takes you to the blind, then that weight doesn't matter.
And what gun manufacturers did was they lengthened that 12 gauge shell. It was commonly right. a 3-inch. Well, now you can buy 3.5-inch. So it's longer. So you can get a bigger payload in there. A payload, like you just said, kind of compares mm-hmm. to the 10 gauge, kind of rendering the 10 gauge a little bit obsolete. Now, that said, you made a pretty strong case that there's still some advantages of using the 12 gauge. Yeah. You like the pattern for starters?
The pattern is the bigger bore tends to pattern bigger pellets better. It's not a huge difference, but it is a difference. If you do a lot of, not even that popular anymore, but a lot of pass shooting at geese, say on a refuge line or whatever, a 10 gauge is going to shoot with large steel shot, will shoot better patterns. And the other advantage of the 10, what I like about 10 gauges most of all is there's a big difference in recoil between a 10 gauge that weighs 10, 12 pounds and a lot of these 3.5-inch 12 gauges are getting down around 7 pounds or even under that. And especially like an inertia gun with a 3.5-inch shell really hurts. And I don't need that.
Yeah.
They kick and they make it hard to make a good follow-up shot. Now, you can also, instead of buying a 10 gauge, you can spend that same money on bismuth or TSS ammunition and your 3-inch 12 gauge will outshoot a 10. So nobody really needs one. But they are fun. And I enjoy having one and I don't get it out very often, but it's got its special purpose.
I think that kick element is a little counterintuitive to folks who think, well, that 10's got to kick more than a smaller 12. But the fact that it's heavier, basically it's absorbing more
right.
of that recoil
it's
in
heavier,
the gun instead of your shoulder, right?
It's heavier, and you are, with a 3.5-inch shell, you are shooting basically a 10-gauge load, sometimes even a little hotter than a 10-gauge load, because they can be launched at slightly higher velocities than the 3.5-inch 12-gauge. And so the difference is the recoil. The difference is the weight and the weight that absorbs recoil. And it makes it. I remember my son was about 11 years old. I had a Remington SP-10 on loan, and I took him out to shoot clay targets, let him shoot clay targets with it. He had so much fun. He would pull the trigger, and it would make this huge boom, and the target would disappear. And he would just, it didn't hurt him. It just kind of pushed him back gently, and he would just giggle every time he shot it.
Phil, is anybody making a 10 gauge anymore? You've kind of pointed out that you're maybe the best option is to peruse the used market for a 10 gauge.
Right? It's your only option now. Rounding and discontinuing the BPS, all the BPS guns, including the 10, and I think the Gold 10 is gone too. So really, for a while, there were just three. There was the BPS pump, which I had for a while. There's the Gold 10, which is what I have now, and then the Remington SP-10. In the Remington SP-10 was basically a redesign of the Ithaca Mag-10, which there's still a few of those around. And then there were some double guns made over the years in 10 gauge. So there's not a lot of choices out there. You can find them. There's still ammunition for them. That's not a problem. But the finding a new gun is a problem because there aren't any.
Gotcha. You listen to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Jerisan. We are talking with Philip Borgeli about shotgunning a little bit. You just made a solid case for why you should go buy a used 10 gauge shotgun, especially if you're in the early season pass shooting for geese or other birds. We got a couple minutes left, Phil, before we let you go. I'm wondering about the non-toxic market. Can you speak to that a little bit? Do you shoot much for non-toxics other than steel for waterfowl? Do you feel like there's some good non-toxic options out there, certainly compared to, I suppose, 30, 35 years ago?
There are. Everything is better, and steel shot itself is better. So, you know, I tend to shoot steel at waterfowl.
Okay.
What I like the bismuth for, honestly, is hunting pheasants. And that comes down just to the very simple matter that I don't like biting steel pellets or lead pellets. Bismuth will break under your teeth, and lead, you know, lead and steel hurt more. So, and because I like to roast my pheasants whole, which means that if I shoot one from behind, there's going to be pellets in the legs and the thighs and whatever, and I'm going to bite one. And I'd rather that pellet broke and my tooth didn't. So honestly, that is the main reason I do it. Ballistically, lead is still the best in the uplands if you can shoot it. Steel to me works fine. I shoot steel twos and steel BBs at ducks and geese respectively, and really don't have any trouble killing them. So there's a lot of, it's all gotten better. The early stuff was bad, but we've had since 1990 to get it right. And since 35 years, the ammunition manufacturers really have stepped up with steel, and there's, you know, bismuth works too. TSS works if you can afford it. And the stacked loads, as long as you keep them to within, you know, they're really made for medium ranges and in, are can be very, very good. The ones that combine, say, some small TSS, a little bit of small TSS with steel, those shoot some really good patterns and are very effective up close.
But I'm guessing you don't like biting down on TSS tungsten loads any more than you like biting down on steel, huh?
They tend to go through. I shot a turkey with TSS 9s this spring and never seen quite so many pellets in a bird because I shot a little low. It was a long range. And, you know, the breast was a sieve of number 9 shot, but they make tiny little holes, and either I found them or the rest went on through because they penetrate so well. So that problem I have not had. It's when you bite down on a big, you know, a steel 2 that's in the back end of a pheasant. That hurts. Yeah. So I don't.
I can feel it as we speak. Yeah. No. Hey, one last quick question. We got our Iowa Pheasant Report survey in. It's sounding like it's going to be a little down from last year. Last year, not a bad year down Iowa way. Any inspiring words for Minnesotans who might want to head down to your state?
There's no pheasants in Iowa. Don't come. I'm going to come up and shoot your grouse this fall, I think. But no, there's no pheasants in Iowa. You know, our good pheasant areas, I think, got a lot of rain this year at a bad time, which, you know, there can be late hatches. You can actually, you know, and usually the other thing about bad years is people don't hunt as much when the forecast is bad, and that means more birds for those who do. So I go regardless. I love it, and I always go. And even during the really, really bad years of the 2010 to 2014, that's when I could go and be the only person in a public area. Because no one was hunting. So bird numbers are down. That means hunter numbers are down. So there's probably birds to go around.
Excellent advice. Excellent advice there, Phil. And I'm serious. People need to think that way more often. This has been a fun interview. Phil, I got bad news. I'm going to hit you up for an interview again because you're a lot of fun, very knowledgeable, and I've enjoyed chatting with you. But I'll try to leave you alone until maybe next fall. I try not to bother people more than once a year. So have a great autumn hunting.
Thank you very much, Rob. You too.
Yeah, nice to chat with you. That was Phil Borgeli, shooting writer, shotgun writer, based out of Iowa City, Iowa, giving us some tips on 10 gauges as well as non-toxics and a little bit of insight there to the Iowa pheasant situation. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Looking for the perfect summer getaway? Look no further than Minnesota's own Lake of the Woods. Welcome to the walleye capital of the world, where the next hook set could be your personal best fish of a lifetime. But it's not just about the fishing. From cozy resorts to charming lodges, Lake of the Woods offers summer fun for everyone. Plus, our charters and expert fishing guides are ready to make your experience unforgettable. Discover the magic of Lake of the Woods. Visit lakeofthewoodsmn.com.
I spend a lot of time in the garage, but even more time in the rain and mud. In 95, I helped tow your moving trailer. And in 09, it was sparks from me, your chains, dragging behind your truck that accidentally started a wildfire.
Spark a change, not a wildfire. Visit SmokeyBear.com, brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Ready for your next fishing adventure? Look no further than Lake City, Minnesota. Located in southeast Minnesota, nestled along the shores of Lake Pepin, this charming town offers some of the best fishing in the Midwest. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, Lake Pepin is teeming with walleye, bass, and more. And when you're not on the water, explore Lake City's quaint shops, delicious dining, and scenic beauty. Go to visitlakecity.org today and plan your trip to Lake City, Minnesota's South Shore.
Since 1967, Outdoor News has been Minnesota's go-to news source for all things out of doors. Generations of hunters and anglers have welcomed Outdoor News into their home each week, enjoying the most up-to-date news, features, columnists, fishing and hunting reports, gear reviews, and much, much more. For less than a dollar a week, you can join thousands of other Minnesota sportsmen and continue the long-standing tradition of subscribing to Outdoor News. Both print and digital versions are available. Start your subscription today at outdoornews.com/subscribe.
Every 2 seconds, someone special needs blood. A friend, a family member, a coworker. Someday, it could be you. In fact, right now, patients in local hospitals are relying on Memorial Blood Centers to be there with the blood they need to survive. And that means we're relying on you to step up and make a life-saving difference. Make a date to help save a life. Visit mbc.org today to make an appointment to donate blood. That's mbc.org.
Hi, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you prevent wildfires.
Dude, I've got this. I've been camping since I was 5 years old.
But I am a camping influencer.
You know what? I'll bet you $5. Assistant Smokey, what is the best way to put out a campfire?
To put out a campfire, drown with water, stir, drown again. Then make sure the fire is out cold by feeling with the back of your hand.
Wait, really?
I'll take the $5.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back, everybody. Final segment of this week's broadcast of Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Driesline. Thanks for tuning in. Check us out online at outdoornews.com if you like what we chat about here, or give us a call at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to print or digital versions by calling that phone number or checking out the website. Outdoor News makes a great holiday gift. Tim Lesmeister here to help me wrap up this week's broadcast. Tim, welcome. Good to see you. Early goose season's underway. That's something you've got some experience with, right?
Yeah, I used to hunt the early goose season a lot. Now I go up to Alaska instead. But I do love the early goose. The early goose, they are suckers for a good decoy spread. And I'm telling you right now that it is imperative that you do not use anything that moves in the spread for these early ones. Just set up stationary decoys. And we used a lot of the fake corn, you know, a corn cob. Mm. You know, you can buy those plastic corn cobs. And we'd spread those around the decoys, and that always made a difference. I don't know why, but I'm a huge believer in the fake corn cobs. So, you know, maybe 120 hard shells. And I know that sounds expensive, and it is, but you're gonna be able to keep those all your life, and so they're a good investment. And some of the fake corn, and you're going to see a lot of geese.
The early goose season runs through September 15th. Then the birds get a break until the general waterfowl opener on September 22nd. I beg your pardon, September 21st is when the general waterfowl opener kicks in. The early teal season, Tim, has already come and gone. We had a story about that. Sounded like, you know, fair amount of early goose action. The Canada goose population in the state is down a little bit. I mean, there's still a lot of geese, but I think after years and years of that population just growing what felt like almost exponentially, a lot of hunting pressure has started to rein that population back in a bit.
And it should. I mean, we got to the point where we were just literally inundated by geese everywhere, and we needed to have some good quality hunting pressure to get that goose population down a bit, and I think we're right where we need to be. Hunters are going to see a lot of geese, and like I said, with a good decoy spread, you're going to get some good shooting.
This weekend is Youth Waterfowl Weekend, so I hope youth are out there taking advantage of that, being safe, and they're out. Of course, you got to be out there with a parent or guardian, and I hope everyone's having a good experience, maybe picking off what's left of the blue-winged teal that survived the early teal season. Ever since that early teal season got going, it seems like people are a little less revved up about Youth Waterfowl Weekend. Tim, there were people who didn't like that, but now that they can go shoot early teal first, I guess they figure... Give the youth their 2 days.
Well, I still hear people whining about the youth hunts. Oh, why do these guys get priority over us? We're the ones that are spending the money. I'm telling you right now, you guys, it's good to have those youth out there early. This is why we send them out early, as we know they're going to get some good hunting. I don't want to send them out after you guys have blasted all of the birds and they don't have anything left to hunt. So they sit out there and they look at open skies. Forget it. I want them to get out early. I want them to see a lot of birds. I want them pulling the trigger a lot, because then I know they're going to come back for more. I want hunters, and I want them out there in full force. And we're never going to increase our ranks if we don't let those youth hunters get out there early and have some fun.
Speaking of blasting, I had an item in my column a month or so ago about the feds unfurling a plan to shoot barred owls out in the Pacific Northwest to try to save spotted owls. They firmed up that plan last week, Tim. They finalized it, I guess. That plan is in place. There's been some backlash to it. Some animal rights groups immediately sent out a letter saying they intend to fight the thing in federal court. The letter they sent to the Fish and Wildlife Service had signatories of like 160 organizations. Some, you might even say, not that fringe. I mean, you know, some Audubon chapters that aren't thrilled about this. Here in Minnesota, as I scanned the letter, Tim, I looked to see if anyone from Minnesota had signed on to it. And the only group I could find was Howling for Wolves. That's the group that opposes wolf hunting here in Minnesota. And I called them up. I left a message. I was actually at my son's cross-country meet when Maureen Hackett from Howling for Wolves called. And we had a nice conversation. she and I don't agree on everything, but you know, she's a nice gal, and we chatted. And you know, I said, you know, is this, you getting a little out of your lane here, Maureen? I mean, you know, spotted owls, saving spotted owls. I mean, your name is Howling for Wolves. That's what your focus is. And she said, well, we're an environmental group, and this is an environmental animal rights issue. So we're chiming in and saying that we don't like it either. You and I have talked about this. This is a weird issue. It's almost hard to pick sides on it.
It is hard to pick sides. I'm not really for going out there and shooting all these barred owls. But we have no shortage of barred owls.
Right.
So if we whack a few barred owls so that we can keep a few spotted owls around, you know, what's it going to hurt?
As I think I said in my column, I'm all for the annihilation of aggressive invasive species, the European species that get over here, starlings, house sparrows, mute swans. Barred owls are native species, however, that have expanded their range fair and square. No, shooting up to 450,000 barred owls in the West is not going to affect the overall population of barred owls in North America. They're still going to be incredibly successful in their traditional range. The issue for me a little bit, Tim, is the price tag. This effort's going to cost upwards of $250 million over 30 years. Man, that's real money. You could create a nice little national wildlife refuge with that kind of money.
A huge national wildlife refuge with that kind of money. And you could probably set it up so that the animals that they're trying to save have the habitat they need to survive and maybe even thrive. So, yeah, they may be looking at it the wrong way. Well, you know what? They can give it a try, and if it works, great. If it doesn't, well, it's hasta la vista, spotted owl. We'll see ya.
Well, in the short term, I suspect this plan is going to be tied up in the courts for maybe several years. We'll keep listeners posted on what happens with that story. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Driesline and Tim Lesmeister. We've got a few minutes left here. Tim, you've got a place in Wisconsin. I couldn't help but take a little shot at the Badger State in my column. Your state's going on like 10 months without a bona fide DNR secretary. The DNR secretary over there is the same as our commissioner. Sarah Stroman is the commissioner here, going on 6 years. But the previous guy left last October, and they still haven't filled that job. And they got this, the International Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies coming to Madison. It's kind of a coup to bring that high-profile event to Madison, the capital city over there. And they're not going to have a DNR secretary to welcome them. They've got an assistant who I'm sure will do a good job, a deputy. But I think that's a little bit embarrassing for Wisconsin.
Embarrassing? It's a travesty. This is something that's been going on for a while now, and it just makes no sense. But what you have is basically these, you have these two big horned sheep. One is the governor, who's a Democrat, and the other big horned sheep is the legislative body, which is Republican. And they just beat themselves up by ramming their heads together constantly.
Yeah, pretty good analogy. Yeah.
And it's like, why don't you guys actually back off, sit down, and work this out? Because, you know, you have some really phenomenal resources in the Wisconsin state, and you're just basically letting things go, get out of hand. More than anything else, you need to have someone in there that can direct this management effort, and it's not happening. So, yeah, it's not just an embarrassment. It's a travesty.
Chatting with Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, I mean, his general take is that, you know, Governor Evers doesn't want to appoint someone that the Republican Environment Committee is just going to shoot down. He wants his person in there. Folks saying, you know what, there's probably some moderate, maybe even a little bit right-leaning people who would be very competent that Evers could appoint that this committee would approve. But neither side wants to play nicely here. And I guess Evers is just holding out maybe till after the election. I know they have revamped the maps over there, the boundaries for the Senate. The state was pretty gerrymandered there. The court shot that down. So they've redone the district maps. And maybe Evers is hoping to get a friendlier legislature out of this coming election.
I think that could happen, too. I think Wisconsin now has gotten to the point where you could see a huge shift from Republican to Democrat in that state legislative body just because of the way that it's been outlined now. So, yeah, he's sitting back and he's waiting because he can have his person, the one that he truly wants in there after this next election cycle. We'll see what happens.
Finally, Tim, I sent you a story from the Star Tribune. A gal, the rural columnist there, wrote a piece about somebody who guides in the boundary waters who decided to go all natural and basically build his own gear to go use the boundary waters. Hey, to each his own. The one thing that kind of caught me with that is, you know, I've done a lot of boundary waters. You have too, with a lot of high tech equipment. And I guess I never really thought about is this high tech equipment, this, you know, a lot of chemicals involved. Am I shedding chemicals into the environment up there while I'm camping? Something else, I guess, to feel guilty about now.
Well, you know, we are shedding chemicals into the water up there. And this is happening all over the world. I mean, the sunscreens are killing the coral beds in the oceans, and we're having microplastics in all of the fish, which is making its way into us. And if you go up into the boundary waters and they're testing the waters up there, they're finding that too. You're seeing the stuff that's shedding off of this high-tech clothing going into the waters, and it's definitely showing up. I don't know how it's affecting us, but it's showing up. And I think it's cool what this guy's doing. He's a guide, and I did find it interesting that where he had a problem was in his feet, trying to make a footwear that he could use that was comfortable for his feet, and mm-hmm. It was very, very difficult. He found that it was really super slowed him down because he couldn't walk over a lot of areas quickly because the footwear was awful, coming, you know, moose hide and such. But other than that, everything seemed to fit him well, keep him very comfortable.
Yeah, I think his original trip was going to hike over 100 miles, and he cut it short like to 70-some, so, you know, the all-natural gear didn't quite hold up, which isn't surprising. I mean, high-tech gear is expensive for a reason, and it works. Tim, thanks for spending a segment with me. Good to see you. Good to catch up, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. I'll be giving you my report next week from Alaska.
Oh, that'll be fun. All right, good. We'll check in with Tim from the North Star State next week. With that, everybody have a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Driesline, signing off for Outdoor News Radio.
Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story and the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.